Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Dale, Kyle Mabry, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the National Security Agency. The agency has something like 60,000 employees, an annual budget estimated at over $10 billion, and that makes it the largest spy agency in this country and probably the largest spy agency in the world. Our guest is the author of a new book that's titled The Secret Sentry, The Untold History of the National Security Agency. It's published by the Bloomsbury Press, and our guest is Matthew Aid. He's a regular commentator to the New York Times, the Financial Times, the National Journal. He's written and lectured widely on intelligence matters. He's now a visiting fellow at the National Security Archive at the George Washington University in Washington. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are certainly welcome. We ask just that people try to keep their questions, comments brief and focused on the topic, but certainly people who are listening can join in. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions, comments from listeners are welcome. Matthew Aid, hello.
Great to be here.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. Just as a way of basically starting, in Washington, in the U.S. government, we have a number of agencies who are responsible for intelligence gathering, agencies known by their initials. What sets the National Security Agency, the NSA, what sets it apart, makes it unique, special, among all of these various intelligence gathering entities that we have?
Well, we have 16 different agencies comprising what some people euphemistically refer to as the U.S. intelligence community. The National Security Agency, as you mentioned in your lead, is the largest of all the agencies. It has probably 25,000 people working at its headquarters, but a total number of 60,000 people deployed in the United States and around the world. It is also probably the most powerful agency within the U.S. intelligence community for the simple reason that it produces the most and the best intelligence available to the U.S. intelligence community. I think at some point in a few years ago, about 60% of the material that was appearing in President Bush's daily intelligence brief given to him by the CIA came from NSA, which I think gives you some indication of just how important an intelligence source NSA is.
Mm-hmm. Now, perhaps the difference between this kind of intelligence and what we often think about when we think about intelligence gathering is that we have the kind of thing that involves people, spies, going somewhere, going undercover, investigating, making contacts, and so forth.
The James Bond sort of thing.
Exactly. The so-called human intelligence. But this is something, what NSA specializes is in something very different, and that is to try to soak up all of the various kinds of communications that you can, telephone calls, emails, online activity, and scoop it all up, an enormous amount of information, and then filter through that to look for little gems of intelligence that are actually useful.
Absolutely correct. It's a, NSA is the nation's electronic eavesdropping agency, and as you correctly pointed out, it soaks up vast amounts of emails and telephone calls and internet traffic and digital data passing over, underwater fiber optic cables, and it does try to find, the few nuggets of intelligence-grade material in a vast and ever-growing volume of information. Now, as you can imagine, the problem that the agency faces is that, the number of people using pagers and instant messaging systems and cell phones and the like is growing, geometrically virtually every year, which means it's becoming increasingly difficult for NSA to do its job. The volume of communication in the world is just vast and growing, larger every single year. So, I mean, there's incredible challenges for NSA, despite its huge size and massive budget. I mean, it just is a very difficult job for agencies like NSA. Remember, it's the largest electronic eavesdropping agency in the world, and despite having 60,000 people, it can probably only process about 1% of the material that it collects, and it collects the equivalent of the entire collection of the Library of Congress every 4 or 5 hours.
And this is something I think that's important and that you talk about in the book, is that probably the NSA has never been able to process all of the information that it was taking in, and now because there is so much more, the percentage that it manages to process is even smaller now than it would have been maybe 10 years ago.
Absolutely correct. Back during the Reagan administration, during the 1980s, NSA was able to go through about 20% of the material that it intercepted. Today, it's less than 1%, which I think gives you a sense of, A, the magnitude of the problem, and B, the difficulty that the agency faces in trying to find those. You know, it's been described as trying to find a needle in an ever-increasing number of haystacks. You know, the number of haystacks grows every day. So, I mean, that gives you a sense of how big the problem is.
Mm-hmm. Well, this also, I think, points up what is a problem and a challenge. Governments go to great lengths to try to keep their communications secure. And with the kind of computers that we have available now and have been for some time, cryptography is at a very high level. So it's difficult, maybe even impossible, to, if something's been well encoded, to break the code.
Absolutely.
So what they're reduced to having to do is to look at all of those communications that are just out there in the open, so much of which, I'm sure, have no intelligence value whatsoever. So one is moved to ask, well, truly, even if you could go through everything that you could collect, how many really important bits of intelligence would you expect that you could get that way?
I have, you know, I'm just guessing, but I'm, you know, my guess would be that 99.9% of the unencrypted, meaning open, clear text messages that NSA can easily access, probably have no intelligence value, you know, at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, you know, if you sit there and monitor text messages, you'll find that probably 90% of them are, you know, teenage boys and girls, you know, going, "Oh my God!" You know, it's just there. I mean, the number of messages that actually have any intelligence value is really very, very small. But NSA still has to, you know, sort through all these haystacks trying to find the very tiny number that actually could potentially produce intelligence. Hence, you know, the need for a $10 billion budget and 60,000 people. You know, I think it's sort of it's apocryphal that the agency is producing less and less intelligence every single year, while at the same time collecting more and more data from around the world. It still is producing intelligence, but it's just getting, you know, that much harder to do it.
Well, you know, given the fact that the NSA does have a not inconsiderable budget, I mean, I don't know by Washington standards if $10 billion is a lot of money anymore, is anyone in the Congress, for example, moved to ask this question, well, we're spending $10 billion and maybe here and there we do get a nugget of intelligence, but are we really getting our money's worth from NSA? Does anybody ever ask that question?
I think every single year the question gets asked. I mean, $10 billion, I think only the National Reconnaissance Office, which develops and builds and operates, you know, America's fleet of spy satellites in orbit, has a larger budget. But, you know, it's to the best of my knowledge, Congress does ask the questions and has asked the question about, you know, how much bang for the buck are we getting from NSA? And the answer is, the agency is producing. It's just, you know, getting harder and harder to produce the kind of intelligence. You know, back during World War II, I hate to go back 60 years or thereabouts, But, you know, the agency was able to break the Japanese diplomatic codes, which we know as magic, and then break, you know, the German high-level codes, which we know as ultra, and using a fraction of the personnel that NSA currently has on its payroll today, it was producing copious quantities of incredibly valuable, high-grade intelligence material. Today, you know, you have, about 600% more personnel producing, you know, a much lower-grade material, but it's still, you know, you talk to, everyone I've talked to says that, you know, the material that NSA produces is the best, you know, it's the best that's coming, you know, out of the intelligence community today.
One of the things that I think is noteworthy here is that people, I'm sure some people have heard the old joke about how NSA stands for no such agency. There was a time when people in the government wouldn't even admit that the NSA existed. And though that has changed recently, we have books like yours, and then we have Jim Bamford, who has written a couple of books. He was the guy who wrote the very first book ever about the NSA, The Puzzle Palace, and that's been some time ago. And it seems interesting to me that people, now they're not going to open up the door of the NSA building and give tours, but they seem to be more willing to talk about, or at least what they'd like to do is promote their successes than they have been in the past. And one wonders, to the extent that there is some openness, what's behind that?
It's that's the $64,000 question, and I wish I had a good answer for it. I can tell you that my book would not have been possible without the cooperation of the National Security Agency, which, as you can imagine, for a professional writer like myself, scares the living daylights out of me. You know, when you write about intelligence matters, I think writers are most comfortable when there's an inherent tension in the relationship. You expect the intelligence agencies not to cooperate with you, and you're happiest, or you feel more comfortable when that's the case. So starting in the sort of mid to late 1990s, when NSA opened up its file cabinets and began providing me with thousands of pages of declassified documents, most of which was classified at the top secret code word level, it just floored me. And so I think, you know, the old moniker, no such agency or never say anything, I think it's become a myth now. It's not as accurate as it used to be, you know, back during the Cold War era when I started writing this book and I could not get, you know, an answer, much less any information out of NSA. Mm-hmm. For the record, you know, Jim Bamford's book, which was written back in 1982, I mean, still has currency and value today, despite the fact that he got no cooperation from NSA whatsoever. I think it's a testament to his, you know, skills as an investigative journalist that he was able to get as much as he was with no cooperation from NSA.
Mm-hmm. I happened to listen to an interview that you did with another radio station about your book, and you told this wonderful story about how at that time when you were in training to go to work for NSA, they and the book Puzzle Palace came out. The people there at the NSA rounded up you young recruits and brought you into a room and said, "We order you not to read this book. Don't talk about it. Don't talk to anybody about it." And then what did you all do?
Well, we promptly violated every single one of those directives. I was training. I was in what the Air Force referred to back then as technical training. I had already undergone a year's training as a Russian linguist, and I was at Goodfellow Air Force Base in beautiful downtown San Angelo, Texas, learning what it was I was going to do with my Russian language training, you know, the sort of the technical aspects of learning to be an electronic eavesdropper, when Bamford's book came out, and the colonel commanding the base immediately, probably on orders from NSA, dragged us all into the base auditorium, locked the doors, and told us that a book about the agency had just come out and that we were not to purchase it, not to look at it, not to talk about it amongst ourselves, and certainly not to comment about it with, the great unwashed outside the barbed wire gates of our base. So the first thing we did, being, you know, a bunch of university graduates, is, you know, you might as well just hang red meat in front of us. We all ran out to the only bookstore in San Angelo, purchased every single copy of the book, talked about it extensively amongst ourselves. And if anybody had asked, we would have said, wow, what a great book, you know. That was back in 1982.
Yeah, it's whoever ran the books there must have wondered what the heck was going on, that suddenly the Puzzle Palace sold out on him over a period of 24 hours or something.
Probably. His supply of books lasted no longer than 48 hours. I mean, and it still is, you know, it still stands as one of the great, you know, preeminent books on intelligence that's ever been written, simply because, you know, I think Jim Bamford managed to put together in a single book, as much information that could be gleaned from the Freedom of Information Act and interviews and public sources, that could. You know, the agency had not, as you said, nobody had bothered to write a book about NSA prior to Bamford's book coming out in 1982. It was an incredible accomplishment.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, is Matthew Aid. He is one of the nation's leading experts on the National Security Agency. He's written and lectured widely on intelligence matters. He is the author of a recently published book. The title is The Secret Sentry, The Untold History of the National Security Agency, published by Bloomsbury Press. Questions welcome. We have somebody here who's ready to go. Others can certainly call in. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Callers in Champaign County, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi. There's an Urbana-Champaign connection that I remember reading the Puzzle Palace years ago and was surprised to see that there is a connection. Some Russian linguists here actually defected after they had to the Soviet Union at the time.
That's correct. Martin and Mitchell were their names.
Yeah, and that's actually what was sort of the beginning of the breaking, the cone of silence, if you will, around the NSA. I've been following the British conflict. We don't even hear much about it, but there's been a lot of activism against Menwith Hill in England. I think you probably have some survey of the NSA around the world, and I wonder whether you recount that as well. I didn't read all of Bamford's second book. He actually has a second book on the NSA. And I also wanted to, without thumping another book too hard, while you're trying to do yours, is the book Spies for Hire, which I think David has had the author on. I can't remember for sure.
About contracting. And
right. And that's what I wanted to ask you. How do you survey the new age of the NSA when so much of it is contracted out? In fact, SAIC, which has a place on campus here, is the biggest single contractor with the NSA, and not coincidentally, I would say Defense Secretary Gates is a former CEO of SAIC. It's a very spooky corporation, it seems to me, in several connotations.
Well, you have implicit in your question, there are about three or four different questions.
Right, indeed.
I'll take them in order. There is a deep and very wide connection between the University of Illinois and the National Security Agency, starting in the early 1950s. Urbana had one of the premier mathematics programs in the country, and probably still does. It's now moved into computer science and electrical engineering, and a host of NSA's best cryptologic mathematicians, you know, the code breakers, the guys who sat there and played around with mathematical formula trying to break Russian codes, were graduates, probably, you know, got their master's or PhDs in mathematics from the University of Illinois, including NSA's deputy director for 14 years, a man named Louis Tordilla, who was a Urbana grad. And NSA probably still does a lot of recruiting at the University of Illinois, given, you know, the strength of its mathematics program. Menwith Hill, for those who don't know, is NSA's largest listening post, located in the moors of northern England in Yorkshire. And and Menwith Hill has been, as you correctly mentioned, you know, has been the source of some controversy in England, simply because, you know, like the campaign for nuclear disarmament program against our cruise missiles and nuclear weapons in general in England during the 1980s, the British, I think, are, you know, the British public, or at least a segment of the British public, are very wary of a huge American military presence in their country, because it basically means that England is a target by virtue of the American military presence in their country. I don't spend a lot of time in my book talking about Menwith Hill for the simple reason that I know a lot about Menwith Hill. I've been there. The problem is that we live in the post 9/11 era in a world where it's probably, you know, a lot of things about sources and methods, locations of sensitive intelligence facilities and capabilities probably should be left unsaid until such time as sort of calmer heads prevail. And so, I mean, I did mention Menwith Hill in my book, but not in the context of the protests in England that have been going on for, you know, almost three decades now against the presence of the base. Insofar as defense contracting and its role in the intelligence community, NSA has always been one of the premier users of defense contractors. You know, a lot of the specialized electronics contractors, you mentioned SAIC. SAIC has, you know, for the last 10, maybe 15 years, has had an enormous impact on the agency. In the 1990s, the deputy director of NSA was a man named William Black, who was, before he moved into the number two position at NSA, was a senior official at SAIC. Most of NSA's big contracts started being directed to SAIC at about that time. You know, NSA probably pumps a couple $100 million every single year into the coffers of its select few defense contractors who are cleared for access to signals intelligence.
It's much more than that, sir.
Oh, I'm sure it is. I mean,
it's in the billions. I think SAIC has $9 billion of government contracts, and a fair amount of that, black or otherwise, are from the. So it is huge. It is a threat to democracy, I think. I think that stuff should all be under complete U.S. Governmental control, so there can be oversight and stuff doesn't necessarily leak and get into other aspects of the business world.
I couldn't agree more. And the rationale is, it's, you know, my take on it is very practical. You know, as a former radio intercept operator 30 years ago, I mean, we did it all. We didn't have, you know, civilians with sort of tenuous or less than tangible loyalties to the U.S. government working side by side with us back then. They were there, but I mean, the numbers were very small. And I always worry that, you know, some of these defense contractors, you go to an NSA listening post these days, and most of the linguists who speak some of these arcane languages spoken in Afghanistan, for example, Pashto and Dari, the U.S. government doesn't train people to speak these languages, so we, meaning the U.S. government, depend on contractors to go out and recruit these people, clear them, and then put them into seats at NSA listening posts where they perform the mission. And I have to say that I'm a little uncomfortable with that, given the fact that these guys are basically on short-term contracts and get up and leave, and you just don't know what goes, you know, what happens to the information that's in their head after their contract is up.
I'm going to jump in here. I'll have the caller forgive me. We're already at our midpoint here, and I would like to invite other people who are listening to call in as well. And again, very quickly, to say the guest this morning on Focus 580 is Matthew Aid, and he is the author of a recent book about the National Security Agency. The title of his book is The Secret Sentry, and it's published by Bloomsbury Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about how it was that the NSA came to be. There was another agency. This was the Armed Forces Security Agency that was doing something like this. And it must have been that the Truman administration at the time felt that the AFSA just wasn't getting the job done, and so they needed to create something new.
You have summarize better than I'm capable of doing sort of the origins of NSA. NSA came into being because, you know, after the end of World War II, we ended up with three signals intelligence agencies, one for the Army, one for the Navy, one for the newly formed U.S. Air Force. They were all competing with one another. They didn't cooperate. They spent most of their time fighting with one another rather than coordinating their efforts against what I presume to be the main enemy at the time, which was, you know, the Soviet Union. So in 1949, the Secretary of Defense at the time decided that we need an umbrella organization to bring all of these fiercely competing agencies and bring them together in a single room and force them to cooperate. Hence, this organization called the Armed Forces Security Agency was created. It only lasted 2 years for the simple reason that the military services refused to cooperate with it. And it was basically left alone, given no authority to manage and direct the entire U.S. government's electronic eavesdropping effort. So by late 1951, with the Korean War raging and angry consumers at the State Department, Pentagon, and in Korea clamoring for change, the Pentagon decided that, well, the Armed Forces Security Agency is not working, so we might as well just scrap it and create something new with all the proper authority where it can force the military services to cooperate. Hence, in October 1952, the National Security Agency was born. So that's the short version.
It's a great understatement to say that since 9/11, there's been a great deal of criticism of the ability of our various intelligence gathering organizations to do their job. First, in the failure to anticipate and to head off the 9/11 attacks, and then also in the way that intelligence was collected, evaluated, presented, and how that was used to make the case for the invasion of Iraq. So having said all that, we can talk about problems, I'm sure, but if you look at the history of the NSA, are there some particular cases you would point to as saying here was one of the greatest successes that this agency had?
I would hesitate to say that the events in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq were a success for NSA or any other branch of the U.S. intelligence community. Rather, it was probably the most catastrophic failure of the U.S. intelligence community as a whole. And NSA was just as guilty as everybody else. I devoted a chapter of my book to describing the inherent failings, why NSA was unable to penetrate the Iraqi security screen and provide intelligence, which, if it had been properly evaluated, would have shown that Iraq, despite Saddam Hussein was a loathsome creature, but, if we had decent intelligence collection inside Iraq, we would have discovered that the Iraqis had given up on their nuclear weapons and chemical weapons programs years prior to our invasion. NSA's main problem, the main barrier to NSA's ability to perform its mission in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq in March 2003, was that NSA could not gain access to the Iraqi communications grid. The Iraqis had shifted all their communications from radio to buried cable, fiber optic cable, which the eavesdroppers were not able to access, which meant that basically the only material or most of the material that NSA was able to access was very, very, very low-grade telephone calls and things such as that. So contrary to a lot of the news reporting at the time that was appearing in Newsweek and other national newspapers, NSA had no hard information, no smoking gun that came out of Fort Meade that indicated that the Iraqis had, an extent and pre-existing, weapons of mass destruction program. In fact, quite the contrary. The few little bits of information that NSA did have were ambiguous and, unenlightening, to put it mildly. But that didn't stop Secretary of State Colin Powell from, you know, basically cherry-picking those few little telephone calls that, you know, that were available and using them at the UN Security Council to suggest that the Iraqis did have a program and they were trying to hide them from UN weapons inspectors. So, I mean, that's the danger of these, you know, overly secret agencies. You they're not transparent, and so you just don't know.
Yeah. The criticism certainly has been made of the administration that in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, what they did was they looked at the available intelligence, they picked those elements that helped them make their case for the invasion and ignored anything that didn't. It was, you know, it's the metaphor of the buffet table. They picked the items that they wanted and left the rest. Though there's a question, well, you also have to ask what sort of items were on the table and whether NSA, CIA, other intelligence gathering entities of the United States, whether they in fact had some idea what the administration wanted and that then they were giving the administration what they wanted.
It's incredibly important question, and one that has not been answered, at least to my satisfaction, based on the multitude of congressional investigations and blue ribbon panels that have looked at this subject. Let's boil it all down. Basically, the number one question here is: was pressure brought to bear on the intelligence community by the White House and other agencies? With Bush administration political appointees running them to produce intelligence to please, meaning intelligence that supported the administration's case that the Iraqis had a weapons of mass destruction program and that they posed a threat to U.S. national security. And the answer is we haven't been able to answer that question, at least definitively. I've talked to intelligence analysts who have told me that there was pressure brought to bear, but not as best they could tell from the White House, but their seniors within the CIA brought enormous amounts of pressure on them to sort of shape, not necessarily to dictate, but to shape their thinking that was going into the intelligence reporting at the time. And whether the senior-ups at the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency and the host of other alphabet soup agencies that comprise the U.S. intelligence community, whether they were getting pressure, from the White House, that hasn't been answered yet. And I have my suspicions, but it just can't be proven at this point. Mm. And NSA, for its part, to its eternal shame, there was a national intelligence estimate that came out in October 2002, about 6 months before we invaded Iraq, that classified top secret code word. The CIA has only declassified a few paragraphs of it, but basically the conclusion of the document was Iraq has this massive weapons of mass destruction program, and it does pose a threat to the United States and our allies. The problem is that what has not been declassified would probably show that the hard information underlying those conclusions was basically non-existent. And NSA was just as guilty as the rest of the intelligence community that it had very little in its files to substantiate the administration's unwarranted claims.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Matthew Aid. If you go looking for his book, by the way, his last name is spelled A-I-D. Matthew Aid is one of the country's leading experts on the National Security Agency. He's written and lectured widely on intelligence matters. He's the author of the recently published book, The Secret Sentry, The Untold History of the National Security Agency, published by Bloomsbury Press. We have some callers here to talk with. Frankfurt is up next on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I think there ought to be one agency handling all this, and I think they ought to get, combine the FBI and the CIA and the NSA. And I think the reason being is because there's probably, quite a few people doing the same job, and I think you wouldn't have as many conflicting interests in there. Because it seems like, to me, everything that's come out, and I've, like yourself and other people, have repeatedly mentioned the fact that there's just way too many people doing the same job and they get conflicting reports. On top of that, I think we went in there for other reasons, but I'm not going to voice my opinion on that. I think in general our security is lacking. I just laugh because most of my family's in Europe, and we always come across this all the time, and they're more stringent. They do a lot different things than we do in Holland and Germany than we do, and we're not taking advantage of that knowledge, which to me is just kind of ludicrous considering that everybody was pro, you know, they're making you go through lines in airports and doing this and doing that. It's all a big fat joke.
Well, let's, you know, I appreciate the comments, the caller, and, you know, one of the things that I'm interested in what you think about is, you know, he talked about, can we just have one agency? Well, after 9/11, what we did was at least we created an oversight person, director of national intelligence, and that's supposed to be the umbrella agency coordinating the efforts of all of the various different agencies. Has that actually accomplished anything in terms of getting people to work better together?
It's a mixed. I mean, the answer is the Director of National Intelligence, who's currently Admiral Blair, has probably been a mixed blessing or curse, depending on who you talk to. It has, you know, it is trying to do force all the 16 different agencies and the multitude of smaller agencies comprising the U.S. intelligence community, forcing them to cooperate and share information and break down the barriers that existed prior to 9/11. You know, one of the preeminent conclusions of the 9/11 Commission was that the FBI was not cooperating with the CIA, and both the CIA and FBI, both the only thing they seemed to agree about is they both hated the National Security Agency. So, I mean, if it wasn't so tragic, I mean, it would be rather amusing. You know, the consequences, of course, that, you know, we missed intelligence and didn't act on intelligence that would have perhaps, I mean, it's a big maybe. You know, looking back in retrospect, it's always easy to be smarter than the analyst at the time. But, you know, could we have possibly stopped the 9/11 attacks if the FBI and the CIA had actually been working together in peace and harmony to defeat the common foe? And, you know, it's an unanswerable question. The caller's comment that, you know, because the various different agencies are oftentimes working at cross purposes from one another prior to the creation of the Director of National Intelligence Office, is valid. I mean, it's, as I pointed out in my book, the CIA and the National Security Agency have been the best of enemies since both agencies were created in, you know, back in the late 40s and early 1950s. You know, there are just, you know, thousands of war stories told to me by NSA and CIA veterans about how much they hated the opposing agency, the NSA veterans refer to the CIA as T-BARS, which stands for, and pardon my French, those bastards across the river. Most of the epithets that CIA veterans have for NSA are not repeatable in polite company, so I shan't speak them on the air. But I mean, it has been historically a huge problem, because when you have, we the taxpayers are, you know, plunking billions and billions of dollars into the system and praying that it works and that 9/11s won't happen again. You know, we're sort of, it's a wing and a prayer. You know, we're hoping that, cooperation will take hold. But if history is any, indicator, these agencies would rather fight amongst themselves than sort of cooperate with one another. And so what we end up with is a lot of wasted money and duplication of effort. The security aspect, you mentioned, the caller mentioned that, you know, he travels to Europe. Well, I travel a lot to Europe as well, and I have to say that, you know, speaking with our, the European intelligence chiefs, their main complaint about the U.S. intelligence community, beyond the fact they laugh about how fractious, you know, how divisive it is, you know, they point out that, you know, in the, you know, because Germany and France, for example, refused to cooperate with the U.S. government, refused to join the coalition of the willing in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq in March 2003. They basically were treated like redheaded stepchildren. They were divorced. They were cut off from access to intelligence. And only now, you know, here we are, you know, 8 years after 9/11, only now are we beginning to repair the damage caused by, you know, the political divisions between the U.S. government and our European allies over whether to invade Iraq. You know, that, I mean, it's it bothers me deeply that, you know, we punished those allies of ours who, you know, they did what friends are supposed to do, which is tell us when they disagree with us. And so as a result, you know, the U.S. government punished them.
Let's talk with another caller. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi, David. You partially posed the question that I had, and which was that assuming that there was gross incompetence in the information regarding the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, that may be a preferable alternative to the one that I think actually happened, which is that they knew exactly what they were dealing with, but there was selective presentation of information because people in the agenda, people in the administration like Cheney, they had an agenda. And it's kind of hard for me to imagine that with the resources that these folk have, that they really were so incredibly stupid as to not know what weapons Hussein had and didn't have. And so I was wondering, I know you said that there's not enough information, but I think there are lots of suggestions that these guys wanted to get in there by any means possible, and the intelligence community was simply used to make the case for the invasion. I'd like him to maybe talk about that a bit more.
All right.
I mean, I can't disagree with that. It's clear. Three congressional investigations, although they couldn't prove that, you know, the White House pressured the intelligence agency to give them what they wanted, the investigations did show that the White House, the Pentagon, and the State Department did cherry-pick the intelligence that they wanted from what little that was available about what was going on inside Iraq, and basically formed it, you know, and used it, perhaps misused it would be a more correct term, to justify a pre-existing policy. You know, it's clear that, you know, within hours of the 9/11 attacks, there's a great story told to me by a former senior CIA official that Don Rumsfeld, without any proof whatsoever, demanded that the Pentagon begin planning a massive airstrike on Iraq, despite the fact that all the intelligence information indicated that it was Al-Qaeda which had, you know, committed the 9/11 terrorist attacks. But, I mean, so as early as September 2001, there was already a mindset within, you know, the Bush administration where Iraq and Saddam Hussein were viewed as, you know, as the enemy, the arch enemy, the arch nemesis of the United States, and we were willing in some cases to blame Saddam Hussein for everything. Hmm. You know, there's plenty of evidence to that effect. And yes, I mean, I don't think it's any secret that the Bush administration had already decided, even before the intelligence community began to marshal its evidence, the White House had already decided to invade, to invade Iraq. President Bush authorized the war plan to invade Iraq in August 2002, 2 months before the intelligence community began to put together the national intelligence estimate that, you know, served as the predicate, the justification for the invasion. So it's cart leading the horse.
Yeah. You know, this is a different story and a different subject, but I guess I'm thinking about it because there have been cases, I'm sure, when good intelligence was presented to people and they didn't act on it. And I guess the thing that I'm thinking of, and it's a dramatic story that you deal with in the book, is what happened at the end of Vietnam when the NSA said that they believed that the city of Saigon was surrounded and it would soon be taken. And the man who was the last ambassador, Graham Martin, he didn't believe it and he wouldn't act on it. And so that's why there was this panicked exodus at the evacuation at the end, leaving a lot of people who worked with the United States behind, who ended up dying. because they had worked with the United States. And it seemed to be because this one guy was being presented with intelligence, and he said, no, I won't accept that.
One of the great, you know, findings that I came up with, you know, in putting this book together over a span of 25 years is that oftentimes the people out there in the field, the intelligence collectors, usually their predictions are more accurate than the consumers, the civilians or government officials who are, you know, have the job of taking the intelligence and fashioning policy. And, you know, in the case of Vietnam, which you accurately, you know, cited, Ambassador Graham Martin refused to, you know, he looked at the intelligence that was coming from the National Security Agency, showed that Saigon was about to fall, that the South Vietnamese army was ready to collapse, and that there was no hope, that, you know, the situation basically was untenable. And NSA, by the way, was not the only agency reporting this. The CIA, which had, you know, the South Vietnamese government thoroughly penetrated and had its own intelligence sources, was reporting exactly the same thing, and Ambassador Martin refused to heed the reporting from the CIA station and the NSA station. He just, he had this mindset, which in part was dictated by policy from the Ford administration in Washington, which said that we're going to save the South Vietnamese government at all costs. And as a result, Ambassador Martin rejected repeatedly all of the intelligence, and it was very accurate, it was very detailed, showing that Saigon was about to fall, and he refused to allow the CIA and NSA stations to evacuate their personnel or take steps to save the South Vietnamese employees who had collected intelligence on our behalf. And so as a result, the NSA station got out in the end, but we left behind, you know, thousands of South Vietnamese radio intercept personnel and analysts and senior managers to the tender mercies of the North Vietnamese. Mm. And it probably, I've talked to a number of NSA officials, and it rates, you know, one of the NSA managers told me that to the day he dies, you know, that image is going to haunt him, that he left his friends, his South Vietnamese colleagues behind. And, it has to be an extremely difficult proposition for any soldier or intelligence officer, you know, to have to deal with for the rest of your life. Mm.
We just have a couple of minutes left, and to jump back up into the present again. One of the big, I think, controversies, questions surrounding the NSA has to do with who is being listened to, and the idea that we're supposed to be eavesdropping on foreigners, and that there is some concern about just to what extent the NSA is listening to the communications of American citizens inside the United States. Is there some sort of a clear statement that that is not what the NSA is supposed to be doing, but in fact the NSA is doing that?
All aspects of NSA's warrantless domestic eavesdropping program remain highly classified. You know, the number of Americans who had their phones and emails tapped, there's only been, you know, we have two conflicting estimates. We have the New York Times, which in December 2005 broke the story that NSA, since 9/11, had been listening into the communications of Americans. The New York Times, based on their conversations with sources, indicated that the number of Americans who may have had their phone calls and emails monitored by NSA was in the thousands. The New York Times cited a figure of 5,000 Americans having been monitored between 2001 and 2005. The former Director of National Intelligence, Admiral McConnell, in 2007 said that, well, actually the number of foreigners being monitored was in the thousands, but the number of American citizens who NSA was monitoring at the time was, you know, he said it was under 100. But the problem, based on my conversations with former and current serving NSA officials, is that in the months immediately after 9/11, NSA was given this job of monitoring, you know, Al-Qaeda sleeper cell communications in the United States, and NSA had no idea where to find them, or if in fact they actually existed. So NSA had to adopt a what we would refer to as a shotgun approach. Anybody who was even remotely suspicious, according to the sources, had their phones and emails tapped. And by process of elimination, over time, you know, the monitoring was turned off on those people when it was finally proved that they were engaged in nothing more nefarious than getting extra cheese on their pizzas. So, I mean, it's, you know, until this administration or some future administration declassifies the documents concerning NSA's domestic eavesdropping programs, we're all going to have to sort of sit and wonder about who had their phones tapped and why. And I just have a gut suspicion, and that's all it is that we're not going to be very happy when that happens.
Well, we are going to have to stop there because we're here at the end of the time. If you want to read more, and there certainly is much more about the history of the NSA in the book, you look for The Secret Sentry. The subtitle is The Untold History of the National Security Agency. It's published by Bloomsbury Press by our guest Matthew Aid. He's one of the nation's leading experts on the NSA, has written and lectured widely on intelligence, regular commentator for New York Times, Financial Times, The National Journal. He's also now visiting fellow at the National Security Archive at the George Washington University. And Mr. Aid, thank you very much.
Thank you.